From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as Congress investigates the intelligence failures that preceded September 11th, we consider balancing the openness of democracy with the secrecy of intelligence agencies. We talk with Locke Johnson, author of Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security. He's served on several congressional committees investigating intelligence abuses. Also, we talk with Roy Hawthorne. He grew up on a Navajo reservation. During World War II, he was a Navajo code talker in the Marines. The Navajo code talkers are the subject of the new John Woo movie, Wind Talkers. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new releases from Bridge Records, a small classical label that avoids the standard repertoire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Military officials say at least seven people have survived today's crash of a military transport plane in Afghanistan. Three other people aboard the plane are still not accounted for. The survivors have been flown to the U.S. base at Kandahar, where they are being treated for minor injuries. The Air Force MC-130 crashed on takeoff this morning. The Pentagon says the crash did not appear to have been caused by hostile fire. The weather in Colorado is taking a turn for the worse. Authorities fear it will whip up the wildfire south of Denver. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Castle Rock, Colorado.
The humidity is dropping and the wind is picking up, raising concerns that the biggest wildfire in Colorado history is about to get bigger. The only good news in that is that the wind direction is south and away from the 30,000 people on evacuation alert at the southern fringes of the Denver metropolitan area. That's of little consolation to the people in the new wind-driven path of the flames. More than 5,000 have already been forced from their homes. Fresh fire crews are staging a new and concerted effort to protect the towns and subdivisions on the northern end of the blaze. They're trying to establish a containment line of scraped earth stripped of trees, grass, and brush. More than 500 firefighters are working the blaze. The call went out for 1,800 more. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Castle Rock, Colorado.
In Houston, the jury in the Arthur Anderson trial has told the judge that it was deadlocked. District Judge Melinda Harmon has reportedly told lawyers in the case that she'll order the jurors to keep trying to reach a verdict in the obstruction of justice case. Anderson is accused of shredding tons of documents and destroying computer files from its audit of the failed Enron Corporation. A federal judge in Virginia has ruled that Zakaria Moussaoui may not see any sensitive material related to aviation security. Moussaoui is accused of helping to plan the September 11th attacks. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Moussaoui's defense lawyers have sought access to material related to the four flights hijacked on September 11th. They've asked for procedure manuals for screening passengers and videos and photos from the screening and ticketing areas of the airports from where the hijacked flights departed. U.S. District Judge Leonie Brinkema ruled today that none of that material can be shown to Moussaoui, writing that if the defendant were allowed access to these materials, they could be disseminated to others intent on attacking civil aviation. Moussaoui has asked Brinkema to allow him to fire his court-appointed lawyers and represent himself at trial. This ruling means that if Brinkema decides Moussaoui may represent himself, he will not have access to material considered important to his defense. A hearing is set for tomorrow in Alexandria. Greg Allen, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 100 points to close at 9,617 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 22 to close at 1,519. This is NPR News. Cuban President Fidel Castro led hundreds of thousands of Cuban protesters through the streets of Havana this morning to bolster support for his quasi-socialist state. Castro has proposed a constitutional amendment affirming socialism on the island. NPR's Jerry Haddon reports.
President Castro strolled slowly for a mile along Havana's main seawall, flanked by security and top government leaders. The march is one of many in recent months designed to rally Cubans against U.S. foreign policy and President Bush. On May 20th, Mr. Bush announced he'd continue the 40-year-old economic embargo against the island and support a citizens' referendum known as the Varela Project. That project seeks greater political freedoms for Cuban citizens and structural changes to the current one-party state. The Cuban government has not directly responded to the petition. Instead, Fidel Castro has proposed his own reform, a constitutional amendment that would make socialism Cuba's untouchable form of government. Dissidents and anti-Castro Cuban exiles are labeling that reform the desperate move of a dying political system. Jerry Haddon, NPR News, Mexico City.
Democrats in the Senate have defeated a measure that would have permanently repealed the estate tax. President Bush strongly supported the measure, which failed on a vote of 54 to 44. Under last year's tax reduction program, the tax on inheritance would be phased out over 10 years, but is scheduled to be revived in 2011. Republicans say the tax forces people to sell off their parents' assets when they die and give half of it to the government. Democrats say the tax affects only people with estates of $2 million or more. They say permanent repeal would help only the very richest Americans while costing the Treasury hundreds of billions of dollars. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Gund Foundation and Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the House opened hearings on the new Homeland Security Department proposed by President Bush. Congressional intelligence committees are currently investigating intelligence failures that preceded September 11th. My guest, Locke Johnson, is the author of Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security. He's a professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia. In 1995, he was the assistant to the chair of the Aspen Brown Commission, which assessed U.S. intelligence in the wake of the Cold War. From 1977 to 79, he was staff director of a House Select Committee on Intelligence Oversight. And from 75 to 76, he was assistant to Frank Church on the Church Senate Committee that investigated CIA abuses in the wake of an investigation by New York Times reporter Seymour Hersh that revealed the CIA spied on Americans and helped overthrow the democratically elected Chilean president Salvador Allende. This was the first Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committee. I asked Johnson what it was like to hear intelligence secrets as they were revealed to the committee.
Well, it was quite stunning because, frankly, very few of us knew much about this subject because it had been so hidden for so long. And the senators and many of the staff were really boning up as quickly as they could. And we were meeting with people in the intelligence agencies to find out what had gone wrong. And then we developed a list of documents that we wanted to see that could help us understand some whether or not some of the allegations were true. So there was a long period here, about 5 or 6 months, in which we were frantically doing research and not really sleeping that much. We were, because we had time limits on how long the committee would last. So it was a rush of excitement, and it was considered very serious because the notion of these secret agencies, the CIA and several others, spying on American citizens was so Orwellian that it was intolerable, if true. So we wanted to come to the bottom of matters. And as we looked into more and more of this, we found out that the initial horrors reported by Cy Hersh in the New York Times were only the beginning. And as we turned over the rocks, we found all kinds of other abuses that Hersh had not reported on that none of the American people knew about, including assassination plots against foreign leaders and spying against American citizens, not just by the CIA, but a raft of other agencies.
Were you or other members of this Intelligence Oversight Committee ever afraid that you were asking the CIA to disclose too much information? And did any of the people in the CIA try to stop the investigation or limit the investigation, claiming that in the long run it would be harmful to U.S. intelligence and to U.S. security to have investigations like this?
Oh, yes. It was a constant struggle. There was stonewalling going on every day and all kinds of tricks used by the executive branch to delay what we were doing. For instance, once we had complained many weeks to the Pentagon about not giving us any documents that we wanted. And one afternoon, a big army truck came over, a half-ton truck filled with documents, and it flooded our quarters with all these papers. So at first we were happy, and then as we waded through them, we realized that they were worthless. So there were lots of games played like that, and when it came to the assassination plots, Gerald Ford didn't want to go into that at all. And of course, Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, was adamant in refusing to appear in public hearings on the subject of covert action. And in a couple of instances, we actually had to go to Washington, D.C. District Court to get some of the documents we wanted. So it was a fight all the way.
And I'm just wondering what it felt like to you as a private citizen to suddenly have access to all this secret information.
Well, it was rather heady, and I must say it after a while, you don't feel like reading anything unless it's got stamped top secret on the top of it. So it does get to be a little bit silly. And indeed, I'm told that in the bureaucracy, often people will stamp things top secret just so others will read it because nothing else gets read.
Mm-hmm. What were the most important precedents set by the Church Committee?
The most important thing the Church Committee did, and this would be true in the House too, where a committee run by Otis Pike did some similar work, was to establish permanent oversight committees, which had not existed before, for intelligence, so that in 1976, the Senate created the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and a year later, the House created what's called the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. So now both of those chambers have members and staff who every day are looking at these 13 secret agencies and checking on their budgets and so on. It's not a perfect system by any means, as Iran-Contra points out, because even with this machinery in place, we still had the Iran-Contra scandal. But it's still the difference between night and day, pre-1975 and post-1975.
What are some of the things that Congress has created to keep intelligence agencies accountable to the public? And in talking about that, maybe you could talk, too, about the tension between accountability and just adding layers of bureaucracy that make intelligence work more difficult.
Yes. When it comes to looking at the question of legislative accountability over the executive branch, whether or not we're talking about the Department of Agriculture or these secret agencies, it comes down to constantly balancing security on the one hand and liberty on the other hand. By security, I mean protecting this country against threats like the one that happened on 9/11. And that means having efficient intelligence agencies that can move with dispatch and have some discretion and some flexibility. Yet flexibility and discretion, as we learned in 1975, can lead to the abuse of power. James Madison once said that power, lodged as it must be in human hands, is ever liable to abuse. And we certainly found that out again in 75. So that brings us to the other side of the scale, which is security, or rather liberty. And in order to have liberty, you've got to have the watchdogs, the checks and balances. And that may reduce efficiency to some degree because it means getting Congress involved and having hearings and so on. But you can't do without that in a democracy. So we're trying to find the appropriate balance between the two. You mentioned, Terry, what are some of the specific things that Congress does. I think two of the most important are establishing reporting requirements. And by that I mean, according to law, the CIA and other agencies must, on a periodic and routine basis, present to the Congress information about its ongoing activities, such as covert actions. Anytime the president signs a covert action authorization, that has to be reported to Congress. And then the second thing is hearings. It's constantly involved in holding hearings, usually secret or private hearings, because much of this information is sensitive, but hearings that help the legislators know what's going on.
One of the problems we appear to have run into is that the CIA and the FBI have kept information from each other. There's a lot of competition between the two agencies, a lot of rivalry. Is this a long-time problem?
Oh, it certainly is. You know, the FBI was created in 1908, so it's been around a long time, and it's a little cocky about his long lineage and in some ways feels superior over the newcomer agencies like the CIA, which was established in 1947. But on the other side of the ledger, the CIA feels somewhat superior because often the people out there have PhDs from lofty institutions and are somewhat smug in their intellectual abilities, whereas the FBI people are more inclined to be out on the streets trying to catch criminals. So there are some cultural differences here and some turf protection differences and competition over finite resources from the federal budget. At one point in the 1960s, the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, refused even to speak to the director of Central Intelligence, Richard Helms. That probably was the lowest point in this relationship, but it's been rocky over the years.
What's the difference in what each agency can do domestically and internationally?
Traditionally, and by that I mean starting in 1947 in the case of the CIA, that agency was meant to look overseas. In fact, it was prohibited from activities within this country out of fear that it might turn into a Gestapo. And the FBI, in contrast, has had a long history of working within the United States, particularly catching bank robbers and white-collar criminals, but also doing some counterintelligence work, trying mainly to catch KGB and other Soviet agents in this country. So the CIA looks outward, the FBI inward, and when there's a spy overseas who travels from some foreign country to the United States, the CIA is supposed to hand off, if you will, that spy, and once he or she enters these borders, the FBI begins to follow that person. But it hasn't always worked. Now, sometimes it has. There are also some good examples where these two agencies work well together, but there are even more in which it hasn't worked smoothly. And sometimes it's personality. J. Edgar Hoover was a very difficult man to work with, very arrogant. And sometimes it's been some of these more organizational jealousies and pettiness that we've talked about.
Are there proposals on the table now to resolve this and to help coordinate information between the CIA and the FBI?
Not to the extent it should be, and that's why I find the new Department of Homeland Defense concept a little disappointing. I think it's a useful thing to do because some of those agencies plan to go into that new department, do need consolidation, but in a way it misses the point because the real point in the war against terrorism is to better coordinate the information among the existing 13 intelligence agencies, all of which will continue to lie outside this new Homeland Defense Department. And the way, in my view and in many other people's views, to develop better coordination among the 13 agencies is to enhance the authority of the Director of Central Intelligence, who presently is a very weak figure. George Tenet, who holds that office presently, doesn't have budget or personnel authority over 12 of those agencies. He has that authority only over the Central Intelligence Agency, but the other dozen are quite independent and don't report as fully as they should to him. And it's because he doesn't have the kind of direct line authority over them.
What are the 13 intelligence agencies that collect information, the ones that we're hoping will coordinate a little bit better?
Well, I could probably bore you to death by going through all 13, but there are 7 military intelligence agencies. The Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines all have intelligence units. There's the Defense Intelligence Agency. There's the National Security Agency. There's the National Reconnaissance Office. There's the Intelligence and Research Division of the State Department. The Energy Department has an intelligence unit that keeps track of fissionable and fusionable materials worldwide. The Treasury Department has some intelligence components. The FBI does, and the CIA, as we mentioned. So it's quite a cluster of agencies.
Clearly, the intelligence agencies fail to connect the dots, as everyone is saying. They fail to link certain pieces of information, which, if were linked, could have perhaps predicted what happened on September 11th. What do you think is one of the most compelling examples of something that could have been connected and wasn't and might have prevented September 11th?
Well, imagine if the FBI Phoenix memo talking about how maybe some people from other countries were in our country learning to fly airplanes. Imagine if that memo had not got lost in the bowels of the FBI and had been dealt with seriously there, but also, equally important, sent over to the CIA for their knowledge to see if they had any similar information. Or let's say the Minnesota FBI field office and its request to get a warrant to conduct surveillance against the person who's now often viewed as possibly the 20th hijacker, Mr. Moussaoui. What if that information had properly been handled in the FBI and, again, equally important, sent over to the CIA for cross-referencing? Very, very little of that was done, and those are just two of many examples. Harry Truman, back in 1947, when he created the CIA, wanted one thing above all else. He wanted all of these agencies to work together in one coordinated whole so that there would be genuine integration of information. After all, Pearl Harbor took us by surprise because there were fragments of information around, but none of it was really brought together properly and given to Franklin Roosevelt. So Truman wanted to make sure that didn't happen again, but unfortunately his dream has not been fulfilled.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Locke Johnson. He's a professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia in Athens. He's also the author of the book Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Search for Security. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Locke Johnson is my guest. He's a professor at the University of Georgia at Athens. He's the author of Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Search for Security. And in the mid-70s, he was the assistant to Frank Church on the Church Senate Committee that was probing CIA abuses. President Bush has proposed a new cabinet-level Department of Homeland Defense. What would the mission of this department be?
The mission of the proposed department is to overcome fragmentation within the government dealing with our border defense in particular, but some other aspects of protecting this country here at home. So it would bring together in one department the Coast Guard and the Federal Emergency Management Agency and 20 other entities, which would then comprise the new department, and they would presumably now working under the same roof, be able to cooperate better with one another. Of course, it's important to note that even though this is probably a useful thing to do, it leaves outside of the equation what I think are even more important agencies in the war against terrorism, agencies like the FBI and the CIA. And the real problem we face is getting those agencies to work better and to work in harness with one another more effectively. So the Homeland Defense idea is a piece of the puzzle that needs to be solved here, but only one piece. And there may be, in fact, I'm sure there are, even more important pieces of the puzzle that need attention but have not gotten it yet.
What's the rationale for leaving the FBI and the CIA out of this Department of Homeland Defense?
I think that if you put the major secret agencies from the intelligence community into this new department, it would just be too large and unwieldy. After all, the Pentagon today is so huge that everyone understands it's unmanageable. No person, I don't care how talented they are, has been able to go in there and really effectively manage the Department of Defense. So you can get too large, and I think that people wanted to avoid that sensibly. So they've consolidated 22 agencies and with a budget of about $38 billion, which is less than the Department of Education, but it's still a hunk of money. And I think this is useful to consolidate these groups, and I think this proposal will pass. It's got a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. But again, I keep coming back to my main thesis, and that is the real problem is getting the other cluster of agencies, known as the intelligence community, 13 agencies, FBI, CIA, and 11 others, to work together. And their responsibility will be to feed information in to the new Homeland Defense Department, so that that department can then react and protect us. So you see, Terry, the intelligence community is in the business of gathering information and providing insight to what might happen. That would then be passed along to Homeland Defense Department, which is responsible for actually throwing up the barriers to protect us.
So the CIA and the FBI aren't integrated into the Department of Homeland Defense, but they're still feeding information into it?
That's right. You could view the Homeland Defense Department that's been proposed as a client, if you will. And the FBI and the CIA will provide this client with, ideally, very good information about what the threats are. Then it'll be up to the Homeland Defense to protect us against those threats.
How much controversy is there about this proposed Department of Homeland Defense? A, controversy over whether it should be created or not, and B, whether it's well created.
I think there's a fair amount of controversy. After all, Ted Kennedy, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts, has said it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I think that's a little harsh. I think it's a more useful proposal than that. But it does have a little bit of the feeling of being thrown together quickly and not fully thought out. But after all, that's the glory of our system of government. Now the Congress will have a close look at this, and there'll be plenty of hearings held, and there'll be amendments and modifications, and I think a stronger proposal will come out at the end.
What do you think this joint committee that's investigating what went wrong with intelligence agencies regarding September 11th, what do you think they're up against? You have some experience in this yourself.
Well, they're up against the time clock above all, and frankly, I think they're rushing to judgment. I've been rather disappointed at the notion of beginning public hearings this month of June because they only got started in February, and they fired their staff director in the middle of the process. And having been on a couple of these inquiries, I know it takes time to interview the people you need to talk to and get the documents you need. And I'm sure they have a good staff, and I'm sure they've been working hard, but you've got to sift through this information and make sense out of it. And then once you understand everything and you have some recommendations in mind, that's when you hold your public hearings. They're going to run into, I think, the problem of not being fully prepared to present their case persuasively. And, of course, at the same time, they're confronting an executive branch that's quite aggressive and preempting them by announcing solutions of its own. And I would imagine there's a little bit of stonewalling going on, too, because the executive branch always knows that these investigative committees have a limited amount of time, so they can stall them out.
What kind of changes would you like to see within the intelligence community?
The war against terrorism is very complex. There's no single answer. A new Department of Homeland Defense is not going to solve our problem. The United States is going to have to move forward across a broad front. We have to improve the coordination of these 13 intelligence agencies we've been talking about. We do need the consolidation of the 22 additional agencies that the Homeland Defense Department will bring about. But then we need a lot of other things as well. The jointness or interconnectedness of these computers in the government has got to be solved. I mean, our government is 30 years behind Silicon Valley in developing information technology. And it's outrageous that these computers don't even talk to one another so that information can be quickly shared. And then, above all, we have to overcome this problem of separateness where agencies are involved in more in turf protection than they are in working together. And that's going to take presidential leadership, not just for an afternoon press conference, but on a steady weekly basis where George Bush brings these agency heads together and reminds them time and time again that if they can't share, if they can't cooperate together, then he'll find someone who will to take their place.
Locke Johnson is a professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett. Available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of American Chica, Two Worlds, One Childhood by Maria Rana. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new releases from Bridge Records, a small label that avoids the standard repertoire. And we talk with Roy Hawthorne, who served with the Marines in World War II, using his Navajo language to speak in code. The Navajo code talkers are the subject of the new John Woo movie.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Wind Talkers, directed by John Woo, is based on the stories of Navajo code talkers during World War II. My guest Roy Hawthorne was one of those Navajo Marines who relayed and received secret tactical battlefield messages in a code based on the Navajo language. The Navajo language was used because it is an extremely complex, unwritten language that was virtually unknown outside of the Navajo world. The idea for the code was developed by a World War I veteran who was the son of a missionary and was raised on a Navajo reservation. He knew that other Native American languages had been used as code during World War I. About 400 Navajo Marines were trained in the code and sent to the South Pacific. The Japanese never broke the code. The Navajo code had two elements, the alphabet and the vocabulary. Each letter of the English alphabet was given a Navajo code. There were no existing Navajo words for the military equipment. Roy Hawthorne told me they created a new vocabulary.
We searched for the characteristics of any particular piece of equipment, whether it be an airplane or submarine or tank. And then we would take these characteristics and match them with similar characteristics. If in the air, then with a bird. And, of course, a reconnaissance plane is unarmed, does not engage in battle, and normally flies at night. So an owl has similar characteristics. So the reconnaissance plane became an owl.
Could you say something in code for us that, for instance, like we need air cover or artillery strikes?
Okay. Think that sa na ke di hastra alkajj.
And what did you say?
Attack by enemy forces, hill 2, 3, 6.
And that was in straight Navajo, or was there like an elaborate code within the language?
It was a code. No other Navajo that did not attend the code school would make heads or tails of that.
What was one of the most important messages you had to relay in code?
One particular experience that I recall was on a combat patrol. And my task was to radio back into our headquarters our situation, what enemy we might come upon, and just make a report as the commanding officer gave me the information. So we came upon an enemy force that was quite superior in numbers and in weaponry, and they were very well dug in. They had dug trenches where their weapons, such as machine guns and mortars, were trained on these trenches. So if an enemy force approached them and tried to take cover in these trenches, they would be immediately killed. And we found that out very, very quickly. We were pinned down, and we stayed pinned down for, I believe it was about 2 days. And had all manner of fire, light machine guns, heavy machine guns, mortar fire, and just about anything you could think of, including grenades. During this incident, the antenna of my backpack radio was shot off. So as a result, our communications were cut off. So I used some of the field wire and some of the tools that I had carried with me, and was fortunate in putting the antenna back on the radio. And so when it was back in service, my commanding officer, who was a first lieutenant, gave me a message to send to the to a command ship. That we needed airstrikes. And so that got through. The message was in Navajo code. It got through, and in a matter of just a short time, we had that airstrike, and that saved the day.
In the movie Wind Talkers, each of the code talkers is assigned a Marine whose job it is to protect the code, to protect the code at all costs. That might mean protecting the code talker, but it might also mean that if the code talker is about to be captured by the enemy for interrogation, it would be the Marine's job to kill the code talker so that they couldn't, under pressure or under torture, reveal the secrets of the code. Now, is that something that was created for the movie, or were each of you actually paired with a Marine who was prepared to kill you if necessary to protect the code?
Well, as far as I know, that story is unverified, and it wasn't created by the movie, however. I don't know exactly how it came about, but it certainly is unverified. I call it a myth about the bodyguard. As I think about that, it says to me that if a bodyguard was assigned to a code talker to shoot him when capture was imminent, that says to me that we would have been classified as a lower-class Marine, as a second-class Marine, if there were such a thing, that was unreliable and untrustworthy. And that just never occurred.
I'm sure for some of the Marines who you serve with, you were the first Navajo they had ever met, or perhaps even the first Native American they had ever met. How were you treated by the men that you served with? Did you come against any racism?
Personally, I did not. Now, there is always a touch of racism wherever people meet, but I did not experience that. I experienced the opposite of racism, and by that I mean that I found that that my compatriot Marines that had never come in contact with an American Indian stood in awe of the American Indian. They wanted to know what made him tick and so forth, and they had a lot of misunderstandings, such as. Many believe that our eyesight was better than 20/20, more like an eagle's, which is not true, and that we could pick up an arrow and hit the bullseye every time, which was also not true. But on the other hand, we had similar misunderstandings about the white boys.
Why did you want to join the military? And I ask that in part because a lot of people might assume that as a Native American in the 1940s, you would have felt very disenfranchised by your country as opposed to wanting to risk your life to defend it.
I had, during my boyhood, my dreams and my aspirations were to be a military person. And so when the day came that I was of sufficient age to join the military, that was the day when I held up my hand and swore allegiance to the country. And that was a fulfillment of all of my boyhood dreams and all of my aspirations. Other than that, all Native Americans have intricate ties with the land. The land is our life. And although Native Americans never owned land, that was not a Native American philosophy to own land, yet we had a control of a certain area of land that we used. And so we were inextricably tied to the land. So when an enemy would attempt to seize the land, we would rise up against them. And so... all of America, we consider to be in Navajo tradition, our mother. And all of these, say, over 300 broken treaties by the United States, notwithstanding, we still loved America and we still love America today.
What made you want to serve in the military? Why was that your boyhood dream? And what kind of encounters had you had with the military, either in person or through movies?
I had absolutely no encounters with the military. I read a book once by Julius Verne concerning Captain Nemo and his submarine, and I wanted to be a submariner. But I was directed to the Marine Corps by federal legislation. But I just had that dream. It was a spirit of adventure that I had within me, which I still do today.
My guest is Roy Hawthorne. He was a Navajo code talker during World War II. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Roy Hawthorne was one of about 400 Navajo Marines during World War II who served in the South Pacific, relaying tactical battlefield messages in a Navajo code. The work of the Navajo code talkers is the basis of the new movie Wind Talkers. Now, your knowledge of Navajo helped your country win the war, but when you were a child growing up on the reservation, were you encouraged or discouraged from speaking in your language?
I guess I could say I was both encouraged and discouraged. And what I mean by that is that we lived in a sector of the reservation where we had a public school. So I attended public school where your language was encouraged, English and Navajo. And then I also attended a Bureau of Indian Affairs school that was a school run by the federal government for Indians. And at the Bureau of Indian Affairs school, we were definitely discouraged from speaking the Navajo language. And if we did speak the Navajo language and were caught doing so, there were some punishments that were quite severe, beginning with a washing of the mouth with lye soap, and then even more severe punishment.
Are there many people left who can speak Navajo fluently now?
I suppose that there are probably, I would say, 70%.
70% of the Navajo still speak it?
Yes. That's an estimate.
And how often do you use the language now?
I use it on a daily basis. Where we live, of course, is the Navajo Nation. Many Navajos, we are surrounded by Indians. we're not John Wayne or anything, but we're surrounded by Indians. And I have a daily use of the language. I have a Christian radio program over the Navajo Nation radio station, and I speak in the Navajo language on that program.
Tell me what you think are the pluses and minuses of living on a reservation as a Navajo.
Well, there are very few minuses, but I'm prejudiced, of course. Some of the pluses are that there where my house is, every morning that when I wake up, I open my eyes and I can look out across the hills and the valleys and see scenes that are picture postcard quality. And so I tell my wife, every day is a vacation for me. It's the next thing to heaven on earth. Those are the positive things. Some of the negatives would be more for the younger generation. The lack of jobs, the lack of housing, the lack of infrastructure, that type of thing.
Now, the Navajo code that you used during World War II wasn't declassified until the late 60s. So until then, those people who were Navajo code talkers like yourself, I believe you had to keep it basically a secret because it was still a classified secret. Were you able to tell your friends and family about the nature of the work that you did during the war?
We never spoke of what we did during the war. Not to those that we were intimate with, like our immediate family. I served, my brother and I served, in fact, two brothers served as Navajo code talkers. But we never spoke one word to one another concerning our job as Navajo code talkers.
After you came home, you never spoke about it.
We never breathed one word about it. Not to the brothers that I served with, not to my mother, not to anybody.
Would you have liked to talk about it?
We never even thought about that. I mean, it was just something that we immediately placed in the inner resources of our mind.
So when the government declassified this, did they let you know and basically give you permission to tell friends and family about what you did?
Well, when the code was declassified, some friends of the Navajo code talkers who had served in the Marine Corps encouraged some of us to form an association, which we still have today. And from that association of Navajo code talkers grew a camaraderie that reached out to families and to other people in relating the story of the Navajo code talker.
Were you given one of the Medals of Honor last year by the government, by President Bush?
Yes, ma'am. Not by President Bush. That was the gold medal ceremony in Washington. The bulk of the code talkers who served were awarded the Congressional Silver Medal.
I see.
In the Navajo capital of Window Rock, Arizona.
And when was that?
That was in November of last year.
Mm-hmm. Proud to have it?
Yes, I am. However, my recognition and my reward really came when I became a Marine. I mean, that's when I felt that I'm recognized, and I believe all of the Navajo people felt that way. All the Navajo Marines felt that way, and that was because before that we were looked at as perhaps second-class citizens, not allowed to vote, and as people who had very little ability. But when we became Marines, then we were recognized as not second class, but first class, and people that had equal ability with other Americans.
One last question. What did you think of the movie Wind Talkers?
The movie Wind Talkers got before the public, or is getting before the public, the Navajo Code Talker story. It does portray the vital need for an unbreakable code. And it does show that the code was developed by a unique group of Navajo young men.
But did you like it? Did you like the film?
There are some things that I did not like about it. I appreciated the storyline. Other things I did not appreciate.
What bothered you?
The language.
You mean the Navajo language? You mean obscenities?
No. Obscenities, yes. I don't object to some of the swearing. That does happen, but the obscenities, I really must object to that, because that didn't happen like the movie portrays it to happen.
Do you just assume people in war would speak that way?
Well, that is definitely an incorrect assumption. Some did, but it wasn't. I classify it as what we might call overkill. I mean, too much emphasis on it. There wasn't that much.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I appreciate sharing with you the story of the Navajo Code Talkers.
Roy Hawthorne was a Navajo code talker during World War II. The stories of the Navajo code talkers are the basis of the new John Woo movie, Wind Talkers, starring Nicolas Cage. We'll talk with Cage tomorrow. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings. This is Fresh Air. Small record labels are often the place to find music outside the usual repertoire. One such label, Bridge Records, is a favorite of our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz. Two recent releases caught his eye and ear.
One reason the big record companies are in trouble these days may be the proliferation of recordings of the same standard pieces of music. How many dozens or hundreds of recordings do we need of Scheherazade or the Four Seasons? I respect and admire a small company like Bridge Records because most of the repertoire they record doesn't exist anywhere else. It's also the expression of personal taste and musical judgment by Bridge's founders, David and Becky Starobin. David Starobin is a superb guitarist for whom more than 300 pieces of contemporary music have been composed by some of the best living composers, including such diverse musical minds as Elliot Carter and George Crumb. On the new fourth volume of Carter's music, Starobin plays a dazzling little piece from 1997, when Carter was only 89 years old, called Shard, packing into 2.5 brilliantly condensed minutes a whole sonata's worth of music. With a wide spectrum of guitar strokes, picking, plucking, strumming, Shard moves from fanfare through lyric introspection to energized scherzo to a poignant, glinting coda that quietly rises and dissolves into the ether. It's fascinating to listen to Shard, then hear how Carter placed this piece, complete, inside a longer piece called Laumen, archaic Dutch for whimsical moods, a piece that combines and contrasts heavy brasses with delicate, plucked instruments. Carter is renowned for his dramatic use of multiple and constantly changing beats and tempos. His eloquent new song cycle, Tempo e Tempi, is a meditation on these very issues, on time itself, times remembered and intersecting, and time passing, using poems by the master 20th century Italian poets, Montale, Quasimodo, and Ungaretti. Its first recording is on this new Carter disc. Here's soprano Susan Naruki singing the entire second song. Quasimodo's poem in Carter's own translation is
we are alone on the living earth, transfixed by a ray of sunlight, and it's suddenly evening. Bridge Records has also given us an astonishing series of recordings of the traditional repertoire, live concerts from the Library of Congress, especially by the fabled Budapest String Quartet. On the latest release are two masterpieces for strings and piano, Brahms's passionate G minor piano quartet and Schumann's grand and profoundly beautiful piano quintet. Joining the Budapest is the underrated pianist Artur Balsam. Here's part of the first movement of the Schumann. Live performances are not as refined as the Budapest Quartet's studio recordings. There are no retakes or patching sessions. What we get is exactly what these players sounded like 50 years ago, warts and all. But they have a warmth, a sense of experience, of conviction, of having lived through what this music reflects. That's something many performers today don't seem interested in. So these recordings are cherishable not only for what they accomplish, which is considerable, but for what they stand for, which is essential.
Lord Schwartz reviewed two releases on Bridge Records, The Music of Elliot Carter, Volume 4, and Great Performances from the Library of Congress with the Budapest String Quartet, Volume 12. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nicolas Cage talks about his movies and his approach to acting. Cage is starring in the new World War II film Windtalkers, directed by John Woo. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.